Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who's got to scrap his old forthcoming book because it was titled Going Rogue, Rickus.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, Ben?
Well, how are you doing?
I was disheartened. There it was. It was the jacket, and it was me eating some baked Alaska. Sitting outdoor at a little cafe, pointing to the mashed potatoes on my plate, saying, I got a spot for caribou right there. you know what I'm talking
about. Are you sure that you weren't in your running shorts on the cover?
You know the mashed potatoes thing.
Right? I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, right, Mick?
I'm struggling to recall that one.
In her Going Rogue book, Sarah Palin says, in Alaska, there's room for all of our wildlife. Right next to the mashed potatoes. This was in the Washington Post.
Have you read it? I mean, come on, you don't have to read the book because the widespread media coverage, I think you can piece
all
the entire
best
book
parts.
Together.
I know. If they did this with with anything else, it'd be awesome. Just the highlights.
Yeah. I mean, why does anybody? I mean, so that's the thing. They'll say this will be a huge bestseller, but I mean, who needs to go out and buy this book?
It was a bestseller for weeks before it was available. It was the number one or number two on Amazon for 6 weeks before it actually debuted.
Well, that's interesting.
9% of the electorate say they are definitely going to vote for her in 2012.
All right, but let me ask you
this. A lot of book sales.
Rick, you are, but okay, so she may have number one or number two on Amazon, but you are the ASCD Book of the Month in February.
Yo, baby. So right now, people should start getting stoked.
That's
Education
right.
Unbound. It drops near you in February. Oh yeah, baby.
And
oh,
so
yeah.
When does that put you on Amazon with the advanced orders? Have you checked yet?
Trying not to get my hopes up. I'm worried I'm going to be at least 6 or 7 behind Palin and Grisham, and it's going to hurt my feelings.
Well, yeah, there's all that.
It's going to be with you, babe. I miss you.
I know. I likewise.
It's good to have our rhythm back.
But the show has been in good hands.
Very good hand.
All right. Enough banter. Let's get to the action because we got some room not just for the mashed potatoes, but we got some steak in the show tonight, too. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly with Mickey. Then we're going to have Amber give us her research minute, and Stafford's going to rate that reform. That's right, a full show here today. Let's get started, Mickey, with Pardon the Gadfly.
Yesterday, Diane Ravitch blogged that Obama and Duncan are putting too much faith in charter schools. Using NAEP math scores from 2009, she compares charters to regular public schools and finds that charter schools lag their public school counterparts and that the gap is actually growing. What should we make of this troubling revelation?
Diane is right that the president and Duncan are putting too much weight on charters, but she's wrong about why. She's right that they are out there selling charters far and wide as a restorative, that if you do this, your schools will get better and your system will get better, which we know isn't the case. She's wrong because the last place you should look is a level-based comparison like NAEP, which tells you nothing about who's going into these schools or who's not going into these schools. Instead, the reality is that, as I think as the Hoxby work in New York shows, that done right, done smart, charters can definitely deliver much better results for kids. But it's not a one-size-fix-all, cure it, do it today, do it as widely as possible. It's how do you support and nurture smart, high-quality systems of charters?
Very well said. A little boring, but well said.
Ow. Man.
But, I wrote back to Diane today, and I told her, look, I actually think we are never going to answer this question about whether charters are more effective than traditional public schools, even with these randomized assignments.
It's the wrong question.
Well, all right. That's your boring blah, blah, blah. But what I'm going to say is... what's the intervention? I think for a lot of us, it's been that, well, if we could get, an environment where there's not a teacher union contract and there's not the central office red tape and the principal has more autonomy and the teachers, all these conditions, you'd get better results. The confounding factor is that you also have a different group of kids coming into these schools. And even if you can compare how those kids do compared to similar kids that didn't go to the charter schools, what you can't compare is what does it mean when you take a group of kids from sort of in-the-know parents who have found these schools, that's important. The peer group matters, and you're never going to be able to tease out exactly how much that matters compared to the other stuff. I mean, I think Kip's doing great stuff, but I think Kip is also doing a great job of being a magnet for motivated kids, for motivated families that also are poor, and that's a huge part of the story.
You know, I think that that's a terrific concern. But just to dial it back a sec, I mean, right, most charters don't actually have all that autonomy that you just outlined, right? Charter schooling in Maryland or Virginia is real different from charter schooling.
Oh, you mean the six schools that you're talking about?
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, even this notion of what a charter school is, yeah. A charter school is not any one thing. But the president and the secretary are out there talking about charters as if there is either a district school mm-hmm. model or a charter model. Which is just confusing the hell out of the American public.
It's like how they always like to lump us, you know, right of center education policy wonks in together, like we're just all the same.
All four of us?
It's just like that. Okay, Mickey, question number two.
Last week, Checker and Rick took to the web screens of the NRO and the Gadfly to discuss the Education Department's recent report on the effects of the stimulus. The bottom line, jobs have been created or saved, but there hasn't been much education reform. Is this really a surprise? And do you think the stimulus money spent thus far could have accomplished both fast-acting job creation and reform in education at the same time?
So first of all, Rick, I noticed that you and Checker take it as a given that the administration's jobs numbers are sound. And I understand that may make you the only ones in Washington on either side of the aisle that actually just stipulate that we can believe that 400,000 teacher jobs or whatever were saved.
I thought we would get credit from the Kevin Careys for that. We were being generous. We were saying, even if you posit that they're not making this stuff up.
Okay. Well, so I think this is tricky. I mean, those, you know, when we followed the whole stimulus thing, we know that Congress was going to put a whole bunch of money into education to save teacher jobs. You can, you know, for maybe some valid reasons economically, right? And then there was some push on behalf of reformers to say, well, hey, let's at least extract something from the education system in return. The administration was very focused, you know, was on board with that, put some pressure on Congress to make sure there was some reform we got as a result. And so, I don't know, I mean, your whole piece, can't you just say, look, I mean, wasn't the choice really, do we bail out the school system and get nothing in return, or do we bail out the school system and get a little bit of something in return? So why are you being so stingy?
I mean, the first thing to keep in mind is that we're borrowing, right? The education money is $110 billion that we're borrowing from NECO and from the new little one mm-hmm. so that we can avoid making hard choices today. So if we're actually going to rationalize this, it seems that we ought to set a higher bar than that we're going to try to spend 4 or 5 cents on the dollar in a way that might lead to slightly beneficial results other than protecting jobs for adults today. That's one thing. But the second thing is the administration made it real clear that they were justifying this money as a down payment on transformation. Mm-hmm. That they wanted to be judged not just on whether they were protecting jobs and status quo, but on whether they were using this money to make an improvement. And Checker and I are taking them at their word. Mm-hmm. And I think their word is they have little or nothing to say about what good this money has done for kids today or for positioning America to be stronger going forward. All they have is talk about how they've made life better for the NEA.
Yeah. Let me just suggest that by October of next year, before the congressional elections, there'll be a lot of talk about how we saved your teacher's job. Mm-hmm. And not a whole lot of talk about merit pay in okay. that particular way.
And one thing I actually want to say on this, because it strikes me that it's relevant, that Obama is either one of the worst negotiators among attorneys that I've ever heard about, and Duncan is not particularly sly at the bargaining table, or else they just checked out for months back in the spring. Because when you're holding $110 billion and you can say to the NEA and the AFT, hey, guys, we're going to push for a huge Christmas gift for you, but we need some payback in return. They didn't.
Okay, Mickey, topic number three.
Massachusetts is considering some intriguing new legislation. Not only would it eliminate the current state cap on non-unionized and unionized charters, but it would also do away with the stipulation that no more than 4% of students statewide may be enrolled in charters. In the state's worst 29 districts, the amount of school spending going to charters would gradually double from 9 to 18%. Is this cause for celebration?
Woohoo!
Was that a faint woohoo?
No, yeah, sure, this is great.
I mean, it sounds like a faint-hearted woohoo, babe.
I don't know. No, look, it helps at the margins. You know, I think there is an argument that says that part of the reason Massachusetts charter schools are so good, like in New York, is because of the cap. Even though that's artificial, it did create some pressure on the authorizers to say, hey, we only have so many school slots to hand out. Let's be real selective. And so by all means, there should be more charter schools in Massachusetts, but you also don't want to blow it out entirely. I think it's not the worst thing to have a little bit of tension there that continues to create incentives for authorizers to be very careful and selective.
I mean, one of the interesting questions is it'll give us a chance to look at the old pilot program dilemma, right? Arizona's got lots of charters, yeah, and very few folks would say that, you know, across the board, they've got, you know, many that are real impressive. And one of the things in Massachusetts that Stephen Wilson, for instance, has pointed out is how many of these charters are fueled by all of these Harvard and elite college graduates running around. If you start to dramatically grow the number of charters in Massachusetts, it'll be a really interesting case to see, can you attract enough talent to keep staffing these new schools at the same level?
Right.
And are these added schools, especially if they're run by the same providers as who are currently operating, as effective?
Okay, Amber's Research Minute.
Mike, you know what I like about Amber?
What's that?
Everything.
Ooh, there it is. You know what's the best about this segment? It proves that less is more.
Mm. Now I'm going to go over.
No, all right, Amber, what's the topic?
The pressure. This week we have a study by NBER that examines the impact of the Harlem Children's Zone. We've all been waiting for this one, which I'll shorten as the Zone, on educational outcomes. This is a 97-block area in central Harlem that offers social services to students and families living in the zone and out of it, as well as high-quality charter schools. The study used a couple different methods to measure academic gains, the more robust of which was a comparison of students accepted and rejected by a lottery. Researchers found that students enrolled in sixth grade gained more than 4/5 of a standard deviation, that's a lot, in math and a little less in English language arts by grade 8, which researchers say is enough to close the black-white achievement gap in math and reduce it by half in English language arts. Also, students of all ability levels obtain roughly the same benefit attending zone charters. However, this is important, the study found that community initiatives alone are unsuccessful at increasing performance. High-quality schools combined with these initiatives are, but the report could not untangle whether it was just the high-quality schools that caused the gains or both the schools and the social services. Finally, the price tag, about $20,000 per pupil. Total budget for the zone, $50 million a year.
Oof. That's a lot of moolah.
Give me my time.
Mm-hmm. You did good. You just a little over.
104. But you know what? I'm going to give you the 4 because that was tight.
That was tight. Yeah. So this is like, this is the, you know, broader, bolder, coming together with the no excuses world all in one.
It is.
All right, quick quiz time. What does NBER stand for, Mike?
National Bureau of Economic Research.
Yeah, bada bing.
Yes. Wow. You have become an econometrician in your spare time.
Watch out, Rick. Watch out. I might be coming over to your space.
Nice. He's tight.
He's tight.
So, Amber, quick thoughts on this? Good news, bad news?
I mean, you know, I thought it was unsurprising. I mean, of course, these kids are going to do better. They've got, you know, a ton of social services, high-quality charter schools. I think it's just, you know, we got to question, you know, the price tag and scalability and all those things that people say. And I think we kind of knew it was going to be really hard to disentangle whether it was the schools or the services. And, you know, it's obviously tough work to do. So there you have it.
It takes a village and it takes a school. It's not really as good a slogan, though, is it? All right. So Amber,
that could be the concluding chapter for Progressive Parents Dilemma, Bip.
That could be. Yeah.
It takes a village. Ellipsis. Dot. 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 And it takes a school.
Yeah. 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 Stick to your own books, Rick. Hands off.
Education Unbound, baby. All right. Drops near you. February.
How many times are we going to say it in one podcast?
We're going to say it.
So Amber, what's the song that goes along with this?
So the song, since this zone has to raise some hefty funds, we have Donna Summers. She works hard for the money.
Hey, Mike, now I thought you were going to go, there was from the Top Gun soundtrack, there was something about zone, wasn't there?
Oh, what was into the Danger Zone.
Danger Zone,
that would have been a good one.
Yeah.
Good movie.
And I actually have that soundtrack, I could have brought it in. So, I remember being in eighth grade when that movie came out, and I brought the picture of Tom Cruise into my barber's shop, and I said, "Can you make my hair look like that?"
Nice. And what'd he say?
Oh, the answer was basically no. So, but we gave it a try.
Nice.
I did get a leather jacket, of course.
I took a picture of Kelly McGillis in my haircut. I said, "Sorry." Good locks, man.
And so you went with the flock of seagulls look instead.
What are you going
to
do?
Okay, it is now time to rate that reform. I mean, that reference was really unfair, but I've had the pleasure of being over at Rick's mother's house, and she's got a picture of Rick from high school, and he does, he has the flock of seagulls, floppy hairdo, and it's just, it's great. It's classic. I love it.
No defense.
All right, Steph.
All right.
Oh, by the way, hi Rick's mom. She's probably listening.
Hey, Mom.
Okay, Stafford, what are we rating today?
Well, today's Rate That Reform is not actually about a reform, but the lack of one. This week, Florida's Miami-Dade County School Board is, quote-unquote, considering a ban on school bus drivers texting while driving. Considering? With some 40-odd kiddos as your cargo, there should be no consideration going on here. No texting while driving, period. Unfortunately, it turns out that only 19 states plus D.C. actually ban texting while driving, a disappointingly low number, and only 21 states plus D.C. even ban handheld phones. 17 states, plus D.C. again, specifically ban handheld phones for bus drivers, but only one bans school bus drivers from texting specifically, and that's Texas. Though, there's a stipulation to this, which is that bus drivers are only allowed to text, or they are allowed to text, if their passengers are over the age of 17. I guess if you've got some 18-year-old seniors in your bus, text away. In any event, Florida, the scene of today's offense against children, not only does not ban texting, not even by those with learner's permits, which is a pretty pervasive stipulation, but it doesn't ban handheld phone use at all. So I was going to give Miami-Dade a hard time for its quote-unquote considering something that should be a no-brainer, but given the delinquency of so many other states in this front, I suppose we should grudgingly applaud Miami-Dade for getting around to this. Better late than ever, right? So I'll give him a B.
So a couple thoughts here. Just the other day I was watching some old Schoolhouse Rock with my son Nico, including I'm Just a Bill on Capitol Hill. Classic.
Great.
Right?
And
do you remember what the bill was? Was a bill to have to make buses stop, school buses stop at railroad tracks. Now this texting while driving, this seems pretty easy. That if listening out there, teachers, if you're a civics teacher, a social studies teacher, this is a great project for your kids to try to get your state to pass a law to ban school bus drivers from texting while driving. I think you could get this through your state legislature and have a big victory for your kids. In fact, I mean, I think like if you wanted to see some real success as a nonprofit organization and show some really advocacy wins, this is a great issue to take up. I mean, who's against this?
You
know what, Stafford, I want you to watch this, and if Miami-Dade comes through with a ban on texting, I hope you'll report here on the Education Gadfly Show.
I will do so.
All right, well, that's all the time we got for the show today. Until next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show here at edexcellence.net, signing off.